playbook said a new hospital could be a major new clinical building on an existing site or a new wing of an existing hospital, provided it contains a whole clinical service, such as maternity or children's services, or a major refurbishment and alteration of all but building frame or main structure, delivering a significant extension to useful life, which includes major or visible changes to the external structure. Staff were told that all the schemes must always be referred to as a new hospital. Recently, the BBC's Reality Check programme emailed every National Health Service Trust involved in the scheme, asking which of three categories their project fitted into. Of the 34 NHS trusts which replied, only five said they were building a whole new hospital. 12 NHS trusts said they were building new wings, and nine said they were rebuilding existing hospital buildings. With inflation now running at over 9%, there are also growing fears within government that even some of these extensions could prove to be unaffordable. Several hospitals earmarked for building work, including centres in Leeds, Leicester and Manchester, are among those still waiting to hear what scale of work can go ahead and when. Already, delays to building projects have resulted in additional cost to the taxpayer. The Leeds General Infirmary estimates the cost of development for two new buildings will be at least £75 million or more than first planned due to delays to starting construction and the rising costs of building works. Reacting to the National Audit Office's decision to launch a review and report back in 2023 in the run-up to the next general election, Wes Streeting said, "The only place these 40 new hospitals currently exist is in Boris Johnson's imagination." The election manifesto promise now looks to be another example of the Conservatives overpromising and underdelivering. He added, "Labour will get value for taxpayers' money and ensure that every penny going to the National Health Service is spent wisely, providing better care for patients." The Liberal Democrats' deputy leader and spokesperson on health, Daisy Cooper, said, "Before MPs break up for the summer, the government must publish a clear timetable for its new hospitals programme and explain why they are failing to deliver their number one health pledge," adding, "If they don't deliver on their number one health promise, it will be an ultimate betrayal." On its own website, the government claims, "Hospitals come in different shapes and sizes, and each new hospital will be designed to meet the needs of the local area, staff and patients, now and in the future." Matthew Taylor, the chief executive of the NHS Confederation, recently cast doubt on whether many schemes would get off the ground. He said, "The government launched these flagship new builds with much fanfare, but National Health Service leaders are becoming increasingly frustrated that the money isn't following through. Matthew Taylor added, "The fear now is that some of these schemes may never see the light of day."
Economic Divide.
The Ukraine war is now over 100 days old, and its economic impact has been devastating, probably changing the world forever. Inflation, high energy prices, food insecurity, just some of the consequences which the U.S., EU, and NATO member countries were not prepared for. Hi, I'm Kleber Tafoyi, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will cover the Ukraine conflict now that it has surpassed its 100 days, approaching 4 months. Just some of the headlines we'll be looking at: inflation, high energy prices, food insecurity, some of the consequences of the Ukraine war, although they were in the works because of the COVID-19 lockdowns. Next, the economic war. Well, is Russia the winner? I mean, perverse sanctions effect has taken place. You have a strong ruble, and Russian oil sales still has customers. Next up, we will take a look at the U.S., NATO, and the EU war. Not all are on board this conflict. China, India, and Brazil are just some of the countries that are non-committal, which puts into question whether this war is going to continue or not.
Over 100 days have passed since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. The war has triggered a humanitarian crisis, but it has also had huge economic ramifications, not only in Europe, but around the globe. It is believed that the war has put fragile global trade recovery at risk. The World Trade Organization expects merchandise trade volume growth of just 3% in 2022, down from its previous forecast of 4.7% and 3.4% in 2023. The most immediate economic impact has been a sharp rise in commodity prices. Russia and Ukraine are key suppliers of essential goods, including food, energy, and fertilizers. That has led to a sharp price rise across the globe. The annual inflation rate in the Eurozone in May 2022 was 8.1%, up from 7.4% in April.
The social media reactions and online on the conflict, special military operation, or war, focus more on how much in revenues Russia made since the special military operation in Ukraine. Like this tweet: Russian fossil fuel purchases in the first 100 days of the Russia-Ukraine war. And then it lists Germany, 12.1 billion euros, Italy, 7.8 billion euros. Going down the list, as you can see, France, 4.3 billion euros, UK, 5.9 billion euros. And the conclusion that it made, for some reason, is that India is financing the war. I'm not too sure I follow that, or whether you can follow that. Next up, there's this reference that's made by the New York Times, in which it says, in Russia's war, China and India are emerging as financiers. It blames these two countries for undermining the West efforts to isolate the Kremlin and pending the global oil markets. Then, in the Russia-Ukraine war, the first 100 days, the Russian Federation raked in $98 billion in revenues from fossil fuel exports. Again, the focus being how much Russia has made. This was according to the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air, of which it stated that as a source of this particular piece of news. It went on to say more than half of those earnings came from the EU, which is about $60 billion. So much for the sanctions. Then Russia-Ukraine war is threatening prolonged effect on the global economy, in which the OECD has slashed its outlook for global growth and has doubled inflation projections, warning of a fallout from the war that it could worsen. The organization slashed its outlook for global growth this year to 3% from the 4.5% that it predicted in December, and doubled its inflation projection to nearly 9% for its 38 member countries. In 2023, it expects growth to slow to 2.8%. So after 100 days of war, close to 4 months that is, you can see the impact that this has had on the world economy. Let me introduce, we have our special guests, the first being Dimitri Latskaris. He's a lawyer, journalist, and activist. He's based in Montreal and in Greece, who joins us. Dimitri Latskaris, welcome to Economic Divide. The OECD has slashed its outlook for global growth, doubled inflation projections, warning the fallout is going to worsen, actually, from this Russia's special military operation, that the world economy will pay a hefty price. If we're looking at such a scenario, which is unfolding, and that this is going to be a economic, some are predicting recessions to spread across the world, then why are countries like the U.S. and its European allies suffering from this, insisting on continuing this war?
Well, I think this is very consistent with the prior behavior of Western powers. Western powers have never cared at all about how their militaristic ventures and how their economic sanctions impact innocent people. Never. And this is probably the most dramatic case because in this particular case, they have provoked a war and imposed extraordinary, arguably unprecedented sanctions on a country that is absolutely essential to the functioning of the global economy because of its commodities. But this is entirely consistent with their prior behavior.
Well, let me bring in now our other special guest, Yaroslav Lisovolik, who is the program director at the Valdai Discussion Club, who joins us. Yaroslav Lisovolik, welcome to Economic Divide. Europe, one of the regions, obviously, that has been hit most by this special military operation of Russia, that at this point we're looking at the economies almost across the board in the EU suffering from this as a result, fuel prices, inflation, et cetera. Are we looking at the Eurozone in any sense of the word going through another crisis like it did back in 2008 when the financial crisis broke out?
Yes, with respect to Europe, I think there are several risk factors there. Clearly, the debt levels are very high, and while the threshold that was established by the Europeans and the EU was 60% of GDP as the level that is not to be exceeded in terms of the level of public debt, we see levels at times that are more than 100% of GDP in terms of public debt. And then there is, of course, the problem of very high inflation that is record high for quite some time, and the need for the regulator to increase rates. And of course, there are the problems with regard to supply chains, with regard to the capability of the Europeans to have higher exports and to exhibit significant export growth, because some of the export markets, significant export markets, are not as accessible as before, as is the case, for example, with Russia. So with respect to Europe, yes, this is one of the concerns, that if the global risks continue to be protracted, if the headwinds associated with fuel prices remain significant, then this is a risk with respect to the debt dynamics and with regard to the overall economic sustainability.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of this program, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. However, this time around, we couldn't escape the war in Ukraine and the conflict and the special military operation of Russia. Our first stop is the G7 and its stance on this war. The G7 countries accused Russia of exacerbating world food insecurity. The G7 actually is denying that sanctions are causing a global food crisis, if you can believe that. And it says that Russian agriculture exports are exempted. Now, taking a look at this next post that you're about to see, the UN chief, in contradiction to our previous post, is warning of impending unprecedented global food crisis. The UN has said there is a real risk that multiple famines will be declared in the year 2022. It already has in some parts of the world. The UN chief also called for debt relief for the world's poorest countries in order for them to get a relief from the food crisis and food insecurity. Now, talk about food insecurity. That's something the UK is experiencing. Half of Britons, that is, had bought less food over the past 2 weeks due to soaring prices. Every second Brit, that's how severe the problem is, every second Brit is cutting back on food shopping. The rising cost of living is eating into UK household budgets. So there it shows in the UK how bad the situation is. And our last post, we go to the U.S. and the inflation situation there. North America-based CFOs are expressing little confidence in the Fed to control inflation. The CFOs of companies around the globe actually are worried about input costs and wage inflation in this case. And even the Fed, the New York Fed, has stated that most of the inflation may be transitory, but the bad news is that it is more severe and longer lasting. So it appears that for the U.S., the inflation worries are going to last for a bit of time. Well, that does it for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for an in-depth section of the program. The economic impact of the Ukraine conflict, after passing its 100 days, actually close to 4 months now, is evident in almost every country in the world. In one way or another, every country has been impacted, something that perhaps the U.S. and its EU and NATO allies did not anticipate. Well, here is something else that they may not have anticipated. We're looking at the rise in crude oil prices. Obviously, that is something that has impacted the price, the Russian special military operation. In January, $86.51 is what the price of the crude was, Brent crude, that is. And June 20th, $113.08, okay? Now, Russia's oil, in terms of what it calls the Urals crude, back in January, $79, almost $80 per barrel. You come through in April, a heavy discount of $37.35, ending up with $78.95 per barrel. $113, $78. Obviously, customers would go for the $78. And in fact, because of that discount and because of what happened, Russia has actually accrued more money. It has made more income out of its oil. Well, what's happening with fossil fuels? After 100 days, imports of Russian fossil fuels in the first 100 days of war is outlined through some of these countries and their purchases in no particular order. We're looking at China, 12.6 billion euros. The rest of the world, 7.4 billion euros. India, 3.4 billion euros. Also, the rest of the EU, 18 billion euros. Belgium, France, Poland, these are countries that, again, they should sanction Russia, but they're continuing to buy the fossil fuels. Italy, 7.8 billion, and then Germany at 12.1 billion, amounting to 93 billion euros of oil and oil products, of which the breakdown there, 93 billion euros. So that's how much, actually, Russia has generated income over the fossil fuel purchases from these countries. All right, now we have to take a look at another devastation that has happened as a result of Russia's military operation after about 4 months of war, and that's what's happened to Ukraine's economy. GDP falling minus 45% for the year so far, looking at the economic losses. That's probably a lot more, but $83.25 billion. Crops, 20 to 30% that have not been harvested. And of note, the infrastructure damage, which has come at $100 billion, obviously shows the decimation that has happened in that country. And finally, one of the worst outcomes of this war is inflation. Now, these are some of the countries that have been worst hit. Turkey, for example, 70%. Keep in mind that inflation is not a result of this war. It was happening after COVID. It was accruing. For example, the trend in terms of inflation, these figures actually are a little bit old here because in terms of what we're looking at, for example, in Europe, the EU is experiencing 8.1% inflation, but that is something that has ravaged countries around the world as a result of this war. Now, the EU better be careful about how it's going full force into this what do you want to call resistance against Russia or military operation against Russia? I mean, based on, for example, the size of this protest, over 70,000 showed up. This should be a wake-up call where people in Belgium protested their high cost of living. There was actually a protest also against wages that have not increased. Now, Germany, the EU powerhouse, has issued its own warning where Germans need to get used to gas rationing. Okay, let's bring back our guests. We have Dimitri Laskaris, a lawyer, journalist, and activist based in Montreal and in Greece, who rejoins us. Dimitri Laskaris, welcome back. Europe is one of the regions most at risk, obviously experiencing lots of economic problems, inflation to name one of them, struggling to basically wean themselves off Russian fuel. Are we looking at a Eurozone debt crisis again or a Eurozone economic crisis happening like it did back in the year 2008-09 when the financial crisis actually broke out?
Absolutely. It'll be a different crisis, but it's going to be very severe. Because we're in the summer months, the gas needs are not as great, but winter will be here soon. And when winter rolls around and demand for gas increases dramatically in Europe, there is going to be extraordinary economic pain in this continent. I don't know, frankly, I'm dumbfounded by the sheer stupidity of the sanctions regime that European states have imposed upon Russia. They are depriving themselves of the most reliable and cheapest source of energy. Now, if they had an economy, if they were actually true to their word and they had built an economy that was reliant upon green energy, they wouldn't have to depend upon any country for fossil fuel supplies. But they failed in that regard.
Indeed. Okay, let's bring in Yaroslav Lisovolik, Russian Federation Program Director at Valdai Discussion Club, who rejoins us. Yaroslav Lisovolik, welcome back. Low-income economies are also looking at what is happening across the world with these surging prices of basic commodities, of course, energy at the core, but then you're looking at the consequences like food prices going up. Africa is cited as being a high risk, and social disorder is not too far if it's not happening already. Are other parts of the world facing similar situations where we're looking at social disorders or protests against high cost of living?
Well, clearly the global South economies are very susceptible, very vulnerable with respect to the bouts of instability in the global economy, especially the type of instability that we see currently that is characterized by high fuel prices, by surging food prices. This is especially disproportionately negative for low-income economies. And I think in this respect, it is very important for the leading economies of the global South, I would say, in light of the recent BRICS summit, the BRICS plus countries, including countries such as Iran, for example, including others that play a significant role in their respective regions, to coordinate a response, an anti-crisis response that would help the low-income economies surmount this crisis, also in the sphere of food supplies.
The most catastrophic result of the war in Ukraine has been disruptions to grain export to other parts of the world, particularly Africa and the West Asia region. The halting of grain shipments through the Black Sea ports could have potentially dire consequences for food security in poorer countries. Together, Russia and Ukraine export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even outright famine.
And so in the United Nations, we estimate that as of May of this year, we have well over 200 million people facing acute hunger. And the number of people that may be facing future threats is growing, not least because of, for instance, the drought in East Africa and the Horn of Africa. So a very serious outlook for world food security.
Who said the war in Ukraine is a global conflict? That is the focus of our piece in this segment. I mean, if you really think about it, this wasn't supposed to be a conflict that should have engulfed the world, yet it has. First, let's get one thing straight about the length of this war. This war is not a few months old as some think that it is. In actuality, the conflict began in February 20, 2014. This makes the war 8 years, 4 months, and 6 days old. Why is that important? Because the world did not take notice of NATO's eastward expansion in all of this time, nor the Minsk Agreement, or how Russia was provoked throughout this period. Now back to the current state of affairs. The Ukraine war is not being viewed as a worldwide conflict. This is evident from the way some countries have reacted to the conflict. This is evident here. The U.S. can't force the rest of the world to support Ukraine. Here's why. Outside the U.S. and Europe, countries tend to see Russia's invasion of Ukraine as a regional conflict, not a global crisis. Countries like India, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, Turkey, and Indonesia have remained largely non-committal. What these countries have in common is that they tend to regard the war in Ukraine as a regional conflict, not as the West does, a grave threat to global stability and the laws and norms underpinning the global order. And these very same countries have shown the disregard to the interests of the U.S. sanctions, evident in their purchase of Russia's oil and gas. For example, India's Russian oil imports jumped over 50 times since April, in which Russia's oil now makes up 10% of India's oil import basket in April. It is now among the top 10 suppliers. Meanwhile, China has ramped up crude oil imports from Russia in May, so much so that Russia has overtaken Saudi Arabia to become China's top oil provider. China imported about 8.42 million tons of oil from Russia last month, a 55% rise from a year ago. And here they are at the recent BRICS meeting, pledging allegiances to each other, in which China laid out a new era of global and economic development. U.S. desperation to keep the anti-Russia campaign alive was all too evident during the recent G7 meeting. The U.S. President Joe Biden told allies, "We have to stay together against Russia." This is against the backdrop of how the war in Ukraine is devastating the U.S., EU, and world economies, including its impact on food and energy supplies. How can you tell your allies to stay the course when their citizens are suffering?
And we gotta make sure we have this, us all staying together. You know, we're gonna continue working on the economic challenges we face. But I think we can get through all this.
Yeah.
And come out stronger.
And the good message is that we all made it to stay united, which obviously Putin never expected.
And that was in no small part because of you.
But when it comes to the Ukraine conflict, the U.S. and EU sanctions have not had the desired effects. Simply put, not all countries are following the U.S. lead. In fact, the EU itself is suffering economically so severely that its commitment to this war led by the U.S. may be hanging by a thread. That does it for this segment of the program.
The Ukraine conflict has passed its 100 days. It is now almost 4 months old. But where is this conflict going? What about the economic impact that it's having on the world? Well, what is evident is that there are countries that are suffering from this immensely, and Europe in particular is the focus here. But yet you have the U.S. that is leading Europe into what appears to be the abyss, even the NATO Secretary General saying that this conflict could last for years, aside from U.S. officials. However, is the world ready to go through what it has been going through? Because don't forget, COVID-19 did take back a lot of economic growth. Only time will tell. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you with us. From Mikhail Vitakway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
There is ample reason to fear big economies such as the United States economy face recession and financial turmoil. We have prepared for you an article written by Nuria Rubini. The piece is titled Stagflationary Global Debt Crisis Looms, and Things Will Get Much Worse. The global financial and economic outlook for the year ahead has soured rapidly in recent months, with policymakers, investors and households now asking how much they should revise their expectations and for how long. That depends on the answers to six questions. First of all, will the rise in inflation in most advanced economies be temporary or more persistent? This debate has raged on for the past year, but now it is largely settled. Team Persistent won, and Team Transitory, which previously included most central banks and fiscal authorities, must admit to have been mistaken. The second question is whether the increase in inflation was driven more by excessive aggregate demand, loose monetary, credit and fiscal policies, or by stagflationary negative aggregate supply shocks, including the initial COVID-19 lockdowns, supply chain bottlenecks, a reduced US labor supply, the impact of Russia's operation in Ukraine on commodity prices, and China's zero COVID policy. While demand and supply factors were in the mix, it is now widely recognized that supply factors have played an increasingly decisive role. This matters because supply-driven inflation is stagflationary and thus raises the risk of a hard landing, increased unemployment and potentially a recession when monetary policy is tightened. That leads directly to the third question. Will monetary policy tightening by the US Federal Reserve and other major central banks bring a hard or a soft landing? Until recently, most central banks and most Wall Street occupied Team Soft Landing. But the consensus has rapidly shifted, with even the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell recognizing that a recession is possible and that a soft landing will be very challenging. Moreover, a model used by the US Federal Reserve Bank of New York shows a high probability of a hard landing, and the Bank of England has expressed similar views. Several prominent Wall Street institutions have now decided that a recession is their baseline scenario, the most likely outcome if all other variables are held constant. In the US and in Europe, forward-looking indicators of economic activity and business and consumer confidence are heading sharply south. The fourth question is whether a hard landing would weaken central banks' hawkish resolve on inflation. If they stop their policy tightening once a hard landing becomes likely, we can expect a persistent rise in inflation and either economic overheating, above target inflation and above potential growth, or stagflation, above target inflation and a recession, depending on whether demand shocks or supply shocks are dominant. Most market analysts seem to think that central banks will remain hawkish, but I'm not so sure. I have argued that they will eventually wimp out and accept higher inflation, followed by stagflation, once a hard landing becomes imminent, because they will be worried about the damage of a recession and a debt trap, owing to an excessive build-up of private and public liabilities after years of low interest rates. Now that a hard landing is becoming a baseline for more analysts, a new fifth question is emerging. Will the coming recession be mild and short-lived? Or will the coming recession be more severe and characterized by deep financial distress, Most of those who have come late and grudgingly to the hard landing baseline still contend that any recession will be shallow and brief. They argue that today's financial imbalances are not as severe as those in the run-up to the 2008 global financial crisis, and that the risk of a recession with a severe debt of and financial crisis is therefore low. But this view is dangerously naive. There is ample reason to believe that the next recession will be marked by a severe stagflationary debt crisis, as a share of global gross domestic product, private and public debt levels are much higher today than in the past, having risen from 200% in 1999 to 350% today, with a particularly sharp increase since the start of the pandemic. Under these conditions, rapid normalization of monetary policy and rising interest rates will drive highly leveraged zombie households, companies, financial institutions, and governments into bankruptcy and into default. The next crisis will not be like its predecessors. In the 1970s, we had stagflation, but no massive debt crisis because debt levels were low. After 2008, we had a debt crisis followed by low inflation or deflation because the credit crunch had generated a negative demand shock. Today, we face supply shocks in the context of much higher debt levels, implying that we're heading for a combination of 1970s-style stagflation and a 2008-style debt crisis, that is, a stagflationary debt crisis. When confronting stagflationary shocks, a central bank must tighten its policy stance even as the economy heads towards a recession. The situation today is thus fundamentally different from the global financial crisis or the early months of the pandemic, when central banks could ease monetary policy aggressively in response to falling aggregate demand and deflationary pressure. The space for fiscal expansion will also be more limited this time. Most of the fiscal ammunition has been used already, and public debts are becoming unsustainable. Moreover, because today's higher inflation is a global phenomenon, most central banks are tightening at the same time, thereby increasing the probability of a synchronized global recession. This tightening is already having an effect. Bubbles are deflating everywhere, including in public and in private equity, real estate, housing, meme stocks, cryptocurrencies, and special purpose acquisition companies or SPACs, bonds, and credit instruments. Real and financial wealth is falling, and debts and debt servicing ratios are rising. That brings us to the final question. Will equity markets rebound from the current bear market, a decline of at least 20% from the last peak, or will they plunge even lower? Most likely, they will plunge lower. After all, in typical plain vanilla recessions, US and global equities tend to fall by about 35%. But because the next recession will be stagflationary and accompanied by a financial crisis, the crash in equity markets could be closer to 50%. Regardless of whether the recession is mild or severe, history suggests that equity markets have much more room to fall before it bottoms out. In the current context, any rebound, such as the one in the last 2 weeks, should be regarded as a dead cat bounce, rather than the usual buy the dip opportunity. Though the current global situation confronts us with many questions, there is no real riddle to solve. Things will get much worse before they get any better.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. In the beginning of the movement, in the year 1341, in his speech after his classes, he pointed to the desert, saying that if we ask the people, they would fill this desert. This happened in the year 1341, during a time when many people did not know Imam yet and had not heard about him. Such was his trust and belief in the people. He would appreciate the value of people's efforts and would lead the movement in the real sense of the word. He would keep hearts warm with his warm breath and would not let us become disappointed and have doubts. The people did not have a shortage of Imam's viewpoints. This is related to the era of rejection, the era of fighting the Taghuti regime. As for the era of establishment of the Islamic Republic, Imam's movement in the era of establishment, the Islamic Republic, is very important. Imam's effort and plan was to completely separate the new plan from the country's corrupt past. This was what he was trying to do. How did he want to make this future distinct?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
His idea was to make the plan for managing the country completely distinct from Western culture, civilization and tradition. Imam insisted that the Islamic Republic's plan must not be placed under what was referred to as republic and democracy in the West. That is why I stated in previous years in the same meeting that republic belongs to Islam and is not indebted to the West. It originates from Islam. The fact that Imam placed so much emphasis on the people's votes resulted from his deep understanding of Islam. That was why Imam was determined to separate the Islamic Republic from the two common schools of thought in the world of those days. Liberal democracy, which is based on capital, and communism, which is based on dictatorship. That was why one of the main slogans of Imam was neither Eastern nor Western. This was a rejection of both communism and liberalism, of capitalism and unrestrained and uncontrolled freedom in the West and of dictatorship common in Eastern systems. Imam did not agree with either of these, neither Eastern nor Western.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Virus variants BA4 and BA5 have begun to lay siege to Europe and other parts of the world, a harrowing preview of what may be to come to the US, as those variants are already well on their way to becoming the dominant vector in the country, says William Rivers Pitt journalist in an article titled, Experts Are Worried About the Potential of Another Brutal COVID Winter in the US. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. 14-day average has been reliably clocking in around 100,000 new daily infections for many weeks now, and that tally is no doubt an undercount, given that many tests are currently happening solely at home or not at all. These rising numbers should register as a shouted warning that COVID is not over in the U.S. and that winter is eventually coming. The coronavirus is still mutating, reports Ed Young for The Atlantic. Even at one of the lowest death rates of the pandemic, it still claims the lives of hundreds of Americans daily, killing more than twice as many people as die on average in car accidents. Its costs are still disproportionately borne by millions of long haulers. Immunocompromised people, workers who still face unsafe working conditions, and Black, Latino, and Indigenous Americans who are still dying at higher rates than white Americans. For millions of white people unencumbered with compromised immune systems who occupy a responsible workspace, these vaccines have made COVID a grueling but survivable experience. Vaccinated people are still getting infected in the U.S., sometimes more than once, but their bouts are mild by comparison to the raw deal. COVID may seem quiet now for some. The Washington Post editorial board describes the moment as a twilight zone in which the virus is neither causing major disruption to the nation nor vanishing, and the bulk of summer is laid out before Americans. Everyone is goddamned exhausted, still reeling from the emotional impact caused by 2 years of fear and more than 1 million deaths. The economic side of effects of that long bleak season have most everyone is squeezing their budgets until they squeak. Nobody wants to hear about COVID anymore, and therein lies the peril, because the experts are deeply worried about the potential for another brutal COVID winter across the United States of America. Ed Young for The Atlantic explains further. Across the U.S., almost all government efforts to curtail the coronavirus have evaporated.
Mask mandates have been lifted on public transit. Conservative lawmakers have hamstrung what public health departments can do in emergencies. COVID funding remains stalled in Congress, jeopardizing supplies of tests, treatments, and vaccines. The White House and the CDC have framed COVID as a problem for individuals to act upon, but action is hard when cases and hospitalizations are underestimated. Many testing sites have closed, and rose-tinted CDC guidelines downplay the coronavirus unchecked spread. Many policymakers in the U.S. have moved on. Virus variants BA4 and BA5 have begun to lay siege to Europe and other parts of the world, a harrowing preview of what may be to come to the U.S., as those variants are already well on their way to becoming the dominant vector in this country, the United States of America. If a new wave of infections does arrive, it will almost certainly exercise its lethality on the aforementioned vulnerable groups, who have already so long essentially barricaded from normal life. The pandemic's toll is no longer falling almost exclusively on those who chose not to or could not get shots, reports the Boston Globe, with vaccine protection waning over time and elderly and immunocompromised, who are at greatest risk of succumbing to COVID-19, even if vaccinated, having a harder time dodging increasingly contagious strains.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Aruba Shabit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The recent decision by Moscow to cut its gas supply to Rome by 15%, which was announced by fuel giant Eni earlier this week, did not catch the Mario Draghi's government off guard, albeit consumer confidence in Italy is at its lowest level in over 20 years. On Saturday, Italy's ecological transition minister Roberto Cingolani said he remains confident that filling underground gas storage to 90% by winter, a requirement recently adopted by the Council of the European Union to strengthen the bloc's energy security, is still a feasible target. However, Minister Cingolani argued he expects prices to further surge, particularly after a temporary closure of the Nord Stream pipeline for maintenance.
We're definitely concerned over our gas supplies. Having said that, underground gas storage on our territory has been filled to almost 60%. So, let me tell you, we are doing fine in that respect.
Italy is trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for 40% of total gas imports. That's while prices in the country were 8% higher in June than a year earlier, marking the highest one-month increase in prices since 1986. The energy crisis has been compounded by an unprecedented drought that is sweeping through Italy's northern and central regions. Experts have warned the drought will reduce the country's hydropower output by 60% by the end of this year.
The problems are multiple, and we will not only face the energy crunch and the water shortage, but also the financial turmoil that will inevitably hit the international markets. Let's sit tight, because a financial shock is on the way, and it will start from the US as usual.
Lately, Prime Minister Draghi has been facing problems protecting the government coalition that supports him. A rift has opened up with former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, Also, former Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini has reportedly taken up arms against the executive. A government collapse at this very stage could have grave repercussions for Italy's social stability. Max Civili, Rome.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. They discussed cooperation relations in which Assad described ties between both states as an alliance of will in the face of Western hegemony. During the meeting, the Syrian president touched upon the threats of Turkey to launch a new offensive in Syria. Assad said Turkish pretexts for an aggression on Syria are false, misleading and disconnected from reality, stressing that they violate the UN Charter and international law. Amir Abdullahian said Assad's recent visit to Tehran constituted a turning point in Syrian-Iranian relations. He added that Israeli attacks on Syria are part of the terrorist war on the country. The top Iranian official noted that Iran is ready to help settle misunderstandings between Damascus and Ankara.
Any foreign intervention in Syria complicates the situation. We understand Turkish concerns over border issues. The solution lies in dialogue between Syrian and Turkish security officials. I understand from my talks with the Turks that they prioritize a political solution.
Amir Abdullahian also had a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. He expressed optimism over solving the Turkish-Syrian conflict peacefully, asserting Iran will exert all efforts to prevent any conflict in Syria. Maqdad welcomed Iran's efforts.
Any solution that leads to Turkey's retreat from Syrian territories, stopping its attacks on the country, and ending Turkey's support to terrorist groups is welcomed. We trust the Islamic Republic of Iran, but not the other side.
Maqdad reiterated Syria's determination to eliminate terrorism and thanked Iran for its support. He stressed that Israel must realize that Syria will not remain silent over Israeli aggressions. The visit shows the depth of ties between the two allies and the crucial role Iran plays in the region, as it comes hours after an Israeli attack on Syria and amid speculations that Turkey is going to launch a military operation in the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The town of Alamskia. 8 years of war have left their mark. The streets are eerily deserted as the front line is close. The cultural center was hit a few days ago. It now serves as the town hall. From inside, I am pointed out a Russian monument. While I'm filming the boom of outgoing artillery, two people were killed at the monument this week. The building, like the streets outside, feels like a ghost town. But inside, I find Elena, the head of the council administration.
People run quickly to the shops, buy what they need, and run home. People are simply afraid of going out. I can't say how people live in the west of Ukraine, but this is how we live here. We hope for peace soon, so we can start to rebuild the town.
The school has been hit many times, as is the market and the hospital.
Now, while elsewhere in Ukraine, it's very easy to level the accusations that Ukraine is shelling civilians and civilian areas, here in this town, it's a little bit harder to do so because, frankly, the front line is only around 50 meters or 100 meters around this town, and there's the almost constant sound of outgoing artillery as well. So Ukrainians may well just be trying to